We do not need to say very much about the events that culminated in the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This incredible, terrifying circumstance touched the whole world and resulted in the worst psychological panic we have ever known. Something happened that wasn't fallout. Something happened inside of nearly every human being. And the more thoughtful and conscientious the person was, the more desperately he was affected by this tragedy. In the years immediately following the conclusion of World War II, many prominent citizens, leaders in every walk of life, spoke their minds and their hearts on the subject of atomic warfare. They warned us with deepest sincerity that we were on the verge or brink of a condition so serious that only the ages could reveal the full import. Of course, one point was obvious even in 1946 and 7, and that was that the average citizen had very few resources within himself to meet the challenge of this transition from an age of relative security to an age of more than relative insecurity. It suddenly became obvious that this world would have to grow up and mature very rapidly if it was to survive its own scientific progress. Now, the years have passed, and on the surface of things, we have become more or less adjusted. We have come to accept this peculiar kind of insecurity. Perhaps it was not very much greater, in fact, than the way we had previously lived. But the soul of man was hurt. His conscience was hurt. His sense of right and wrong was offended. Actually, we have always lived very close to the shadow of death. And on our streets and factories, death strikes every day. Yet this was something a little different. It was something that was almost too big for us. Something that seemed to reach out and make useless and worthless all of the common efforts that we could make to grow and be better people. As this situation gradually settled into our subconsciousness, we began to find that that which goes in must come out. We began to realize that in many ways our conduct was different. Something had been established within our own psyches that made it impossible for us to again be what we were before those fatal days. And as we watch what has come out of man in the succeeding years, we realize, perhaps, more really and more completely the degree of damage from which we suffered. One thing is obvious to nearly every thoughtful person, that from the time of the atomic fission, Western culture, Western civilization, more than that, world culture, has slowly seemed to decline as from some kind of sickness in itself. We have lost anchorage in values. We have lost sincerities of purpose in leadership, in industry, in science, even in religion and art. We see as surely the scars of this occasion as we can observe the motion of the stars in the rings of trees. All of these changes man has had to face. And as a result of this tremendous upheaval in our own life, we do observe an increase in problems and a decrease in answers. We see the individual less conscientious, less honest, less honorable. We see young people with less hope for the future. There gradually comes that kind of reaction which might always accompany such an emergency. The desperate effort to cling to life while we have it. The lack of long-range planning. The insecurity of home and the rebellion of children. Everywhere, this disillusionment has struck home. And it is perhaps especially difficult for us because this whole situation is so very close to our own country. To our own way of life, and to the ideals and dreams which we held of American leadership in world affairs, a benevolent, kindly, constructive leadership that was to bring men everywhere into a fuller opportunity for freedom and security and happiness. Some way, we took this very seriously. Probably because it was the result of the ingenuity of our own people. Yet, what has been done cannot be undone. And we have to try to understand in some way the reasons for what happened and how these reasons must be valid and how there has to be a great purpose in the things that happen to us. If the atomic bomb worked a terrible hardship upon our egos and our souls, it should also have brought to our immediate attention something that we have already at least begun to forget, and that is that there is no security in this mortal world. All that which is born to die. And whether this transition occurs in the fullness of years or in the prime of life, it is inevitable. Therefore, actually, the atomic bomb did not invent death. And since those blasts, we have killed many more people on the highways of our nation than died at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But these deaths on the highways seem to be sort of natural deaths, if we may dare to say that any death is more or less natural. Thus, in our psychic stress and shock, we were confronted by facts that we have always known. But these facts came upon us so cruelly, so intensely, and so dramatically, that we were not able to cope with them immediately. Some of these facts we must review now, because they are essential to a real understanding of the world in which we live and in which we have always lived. It is true that we have never lived under quite such a strange kind of pressure as we now know, but we have never lived as such peculiar beings as we now are. It all fits together to make a picture if we can assemble the fragments. As soon as the atomic fact was known to us, we had a more or less desperate impulse to find something that was safe and sane and sound. And we looked around and we didn't find it. We didn't find it in society, and we didn't find it in ourselves. Perhaps no phase of this experience has been more humiliating than the realization that it has brought of how unequipped we are to face major decisions. We have drifted along, becoming ever more dependent upon commodities and conveniences and securities provided by public means or by private purse. Suddenly we come upon something that can only be solved if we think it through with every faculty and power which we possess. And we suddenly discovered that we did not know how to think. We have not even realized for generations what thinking means. We had confused thought with opinion. We had assumed that the tongue was tied to the brain, and whatever way it wagged, it was telling eternal truth. This we now know is a delusion. We also realize that for years the philosophy departments of our universities were poorly attended. Philosophy, at best, could only result in a more or less second-class professorship in some school, where the professor would wander about the campus, accumulating years until he closely resembled dear old Dr. Chips. There was no real philosophic basis under our people. In the times of our great physical pioneering in the settling of this continent, and for that matter, pioneering in Europe or Asia before we got here, man had great spiritual convictions to sustain him. He had a kind of native courage that came from the earth. He was close to the earth. He was used to hard work. He was required to be inventive and ingenious in his own right. He had to use his mind to survive. And he gained a certain practical insight, which brought with it numerous moral and ethical consolations. This is no longer the way of our life. And today, we are frankly afraid. We have very little resource to cope with fear. Faith is not strong. Reason does not support us. The future does not look optimistic, and leadership does not appear solutional. What have we then? We have what we have had for a long time and didn't know it, and that is a kind of mental bankruptcy. In our desperate search for profits, in our belief that this world was a place in which we could keep on piling up cities, and that these cities would result in jobs, and these jobs would increase trade, and this trade would strengthen resources, all this line of thinking had taken over. And then suddenly there was a tremendous shaking of the earth, and we were shaken off of our intellectual footing, such as it was, and left more or less in a chaos of confusions. In this emergency, we have taken various attitudes. For the most part, we have simply been satisfied either to be afraid or to try to ignore the whole subject. We have taken the ground that there is reasonable hope that we may live our lifespan and that the deluge will come to the future. Each year, however, it appears that hazards multiply. And as long as there are strong, ambitious persons without very much ethics and very little regard for human life, power is a danger, an ever-present, immediate danger. And every so often, these persons rattle their sabers or begin to pile up stockpiles of atomic bombs, and the world goes again into a kind of nervous breakdown. So the answer has to be found, and the answer is always the same answer, that we meet these problems according to the resources within our own natures. Now we have been provided with these resources. They are not things we have to invent. They are there. They always have been there. But we have turned our attention to things we felt to be less laborious than self-culture. We have found that self-control is least pleasing to ourselves, whereas to continue to do as much as we can in the way we want to do it holds the larger promise. These facts have been reversed by the situation that has occurred. Philosophy has always existed as a help to us in these hours of need. Philosophy has never been of the greatest interest in those successful, sure generations in which persons were confident that they could control their own affairs. Philosophy has always been most vital when peoples were under stress and the need for serious thoughtfulness increased rapidly. Philosophy was once a noble and beautiful institution. It had none of this dull, dusty, moldy quality with which we associate it today. It has none of that vicariousness, this impotent intellectualism, which we rather regard as ridiculous. Philosophy was the result of man's first solemn and serious effort to understand himself, his world, and the laws that govern it. In ancient times, philosophy was not separated from science or really from religion. They were one body of knowledge. But philosophy was that wonderful power in the mind of man by which all things could be made reasonable, could be made understandable, and if need arise, could be made endurable. This type of philosophy we have great need for today. But when we neglect an area of learning for 1,000 years, it is not going to be in excellent condition to serve us in need. We are told that if we have equipment, we must keep it up. Philosophy is the most neglected part of man's equipment. It has been allowed to fall into the hands of professional thinkers, much like the sophists of old, whose primary concern is merely to perpetuate their own intellectual contemplations. They have made a life of intellect. They have resolved that to them the most interesting of all worlds is the world of thought. And in this world they live and move and have their being. And in this world very often they also drown. Because the world itself has narrowed down to the intellectual contemplation of imponderables is of very little utility the way we have nursed it in recent centuries. But now, the word philosophy must have a new meaning. It must mean the ability of the individual to think through the emergencies of his own life. It must represent a kind of equipment within us by which we can actually solve problems, by which we can re-indoctrinate ourselves with those principles that we need in order to be adequate human beings. So when the bomb went off and all these things happened, and the dazed world tried to understand, a well-established policy was first followed. Everyone more or less, at least symbolically, raised their eyes or their hands to heaven and said, "What have we done to deserve this? Why are our miseries so multiplied? Is it that, like Job, we are to be tested again? Why were such things permitted to happen? How was it that a kind, well-intentioned, good-natured, honest, honorable world found itself in such a mess?" The answer was very simple. It had never been a kindly, good-natured, honorable, well-intentioned world. It had that same kind of innocence that spreads across the face of the small boy who has just been in the jam jar. He was in the jam again, but not the jar in this case. Actually, the atomic bomb was one of the inevitable consequences of man's instinct to competition. War is the most destructive form of competition. We have had war for thousands of years. In fact, some of our leading German military experts in their writings have said that we will always have war. For some reason hard to determine or hard to describe, war appears to be the most popular occupation of man. Now, why does this have to so appear? I think it is partly due to the fact that the average individual craves a certain kind of excitement in his own nature. And in the daily plodding of life, he finds little opportunity for that moment of glory, even though it may lead only to the grave. Thus, war seems to arise in a certain combative instinct in nature. We find war in nature. But we also find that man is equipped very wonderfully to transcend the more barbarous processes present in the lower kingdoms of life. If man cannot be more peaceful than insects, he has achieved very little in the development of his own culture. But we do know that philosophy has not yet been able to stop war. We know that religion has not been able to stop war. And we observe that wars have a tendency to start among peoples who have had many advantages and opportunities of learning and insight. It requires, therefore, a rather highly complex and highly intelligent people to be able, at this time, to engage in war, which is largely now a scientific procedure. Yet we have had these wars and rumors of wars for a long time. And the moral life of man has never been strong enough to cope with this type of emergency. It is a little humiliating, perhaps, to realize that the two most deadly wars of all time have been fought in our century. Not back somewhere in the Middle Ages, when men were illiterate and bigoted and fanatical, but in the comparatively cultured and opportunity-strengthened environment of modern man, with most of all in reasons to live, has been quickest to devise means to die. Thus, we cannot assume that the processes of civilization, continuing as they are, will inevitably cure war. Nor have we any reason to believe that attitudes that we hold, attitudes conditioned by traditional attitudes of the past, will be more productive of peace now than they were long ago. So philosophy has got to go deeper than this. If philosophy cannot solve the problem by saying there should not be war, philosophy has to find out, if possible, why there is war and how it can be corrected by taking natural advantage of the aptitudes of the human being himself. In this emergency, philosophy becomes far more important to us, perhaps, than psychotherapy. The psychic shock of the bombs resulted in a distinct abnormal psychological situation. It gave us the greatest neurosis we have known. It also set us in one of the worst phobias that man has ever entertained. The psychological consequences, therefore, only can be met in one of two ways. Psychology says by adjustment. Philosophy says by understanding. Adjustment means primarily that the individual must learn to live as comfortably, as normally, as reasonably as he can while sitting on a bomb. He is supposed to go about business as usual. He is supposed, if necessary, to put a little cotton in his ears so that he will not hear the ticking of some incendiary mechanism concealed within some instrument of war. To continue to be as we always have been, to live as we have lived and love as we have loved and hate as we have hated, to get sick and get well again, to make fortunes and spend them, these were the common interests of man. These, according to psychological integration, must be restored. Or else the individual will become more and more introverted upon his problem and will become increasingly ill. Well, there is something to be said for this, and I suppose that it applies to a considerable measure of human life. There are a great many people who apparently just have neither the inclination nor the inducements to try to think. For these people, probably to make an effort to bluff it through, to put on a good front, to continue their small activities with as much courage as they can muster, perhaps this is the only way. But it certainly is not really solutional of anything. Philosophy offers the most important of all considerations, and that is that philosophy makes it possible for us to understand through a situation of this kind and to orient ourselves in a large pattern of values which we have failed to consider, and perhaps to move forward a little sadly but resolutely to the needs that must arise. So philosophy goes after the problem something in this way. There are two primary philosophical attitudes toward life. One is that life has meaning, and the other is that life has no meaning. Now, if you belong to the group that believes that life has no meaning, then actually, perhaps, you are in a somewhat better condition immediately, if not ultimately. If you do not believe in the meaning of life, then you cannot believe in the meaning of your own life. Consequently, how long you live has very little to do with any valid fact. If you have no meaning, no purpose, no reason, no ultimate beyond the day, then if you are snuffed out this week or next week, is not too serious. The sooner you go, the sooner you no longer have to pay taxes. And I actually know individuals who have committed suicide so they would not have to pay taxes. Now, this is one way, of course, of getting even with the government. But it's not, we will say, the most popular way. Evasion is more popular. Now, if you believe that there is no reason in this world, and if you pass this concept on as a heritage to your children, so that they will live without reason, then life becomes a small pattern of profit and loss. Life becomes a very insignificant thing. And the life of the individual is not more meaningful than the life of a blade of grass that we trample underfoot. The universe doesn't care whether we exist or not, for according to this viewpoint, the universe itself is a vast expanse of mechanistic unknowing. It goes on like a machine, age after age, millennia after millennia, era, age, epoch, following each other, but it isn't going anywhere, and it didn't come from anywhere. And it has no particularly valuable reason for having existed in the first place. Somebody started it, nobody knows when, and nobody cares. Now this, of course, has a certain simplicity about it. It is so simple that it is obnoxious. But a lot of people try to live by it. These people should never be in a panic over things like bombs. Because after all, the bomb is only important because it seems to interfere with something. If there's nothing to interfere with, it isn't important. It isn't important to a man on his deathbed that a bomb will fall 6 months after he's gone. And if the individual is going nowhere and will never have any memory of how he died, or what the conditions are in the world that he left behind, and he will not even have a memory or a thought concerning his own descendants, having descended himself into this quiet oblivion, what difference does it make? Now, this type of thinking has gained a certain amount of strength, and we have some existentialists who feel quite keenly about it. The only difficulty with these people is that they are a bit unreasonable or inconsistent in their own attitudes. If life isn't going anywhere and isn't going to amount to anything, why is it that these people are so desperately anxious to live while they are alive? Why does this clinging to the moment mean so much to the individual if the moment itself is nothing? How are we able to get so tremendously worked up over spreading the gospel of unbelief when it makes no difference whether we believe or do not believe, we will all forget and be forgotten? So we go out very much to champion the cause of our own non-existence, a rather, shall we say, profitless undertaking. If, on the other hand, we are internally convinced, and I think that most persons who are not sick in some way have a conviction in themselves that there is a reason for this life we live, that materialism is itself a byproduct of psychological sickness, that the individual who psychologically is so poorly adjusted with life that life is only hurting him continuously is the individual who also is attempting to commit a kind of psychic suicide by destroying his own vision of his own purpose and continuity. He is hoping for oblivion because he is unable to cope with meaning. If, however, he has a tendency to cope with meaning, then he is very likely to gradually line himself with the idealists, the individuals who are convinced that life has a meaning. Now, between these two poles, or opposites, so to say, A number of bridges have been thrown at different times during the course of human experience. We have tried to, so to say, sit between two chairs and have only succeeded in falling between them. We have tried to take a little of materialism and a little of idealism and stir them up and make some kind of an acceptable brew that had some flavor in it. This particular type of mulligan, however, philosophically speaking, has never been very much good when it was called upon in an emergency. The idealist stands on certain principles, and these principles are sustained by an archaic, archetypal conviction inside of man. As a result of this conviction, being innate, being essentially part of our own humanity, as essential to our existence as the power to think or to feel, because we have this conviction, we are naturally inclined to accept the significance of purpose. And this acceptance has been universal among peoples. No civilization has ever risen to any height or sustained itself on a cultural level for any length of time without this sense of interior life purpose. And very few individuals have ever succeeded in this world who did not sense purpose in themselves or realize a certain dedication to a concept, a conviction, an ideal, a principle, a belief, or a policy which was important. Now, if we finally line ourselves with the vitalists rather than the mechanists, with those who believe in value rather than those who believe in nothing, then we are on a bit of a dilemma regarding our own weaknesses of character. So we try to rationalize this in the terms of what the modern world has in the form of its philosophical heritage with which to meet this tremendous imponderable that is becoming a little more ponderable all the time. If the universe has a purpose, how is this purpose established? Is there at the root of existence a plan? Does this plan exist in the mind of a planner? Is there some will operating in space by which all things, by willing itself, are moved into the patterns and relationships that are essential? Religion naturally insists that this is true. The religious phase of the problem will be discussed in another evening. Tonight we are primarily concerned with the philosophical implications. Now, philosophy is not only a process of reasoning, it is a process by which reason causes us to recognize what we really believe. Reason makes available to us our own convictions. For there is an instinctive tendency in the mind of the individual to accept the reasonable and to reject the unreasonable. He likes that which is reasonable and proper. So we have to decide in a sort of general way whether this universe is a conscious, intelligent, or reasonable creation. If it is any of these things, we are then confronted with a still more interesting speculation. If we wish to assume that the influence or power of things is to a measure dependent upon their relationship to other things, then we must assume that the universe, cosmos, universal systems, cosmic chains, this vast mass of worlds forming the inhabitants of space. This is pretty big. It is larger than we are. It is infinitely more powerful. And as far as we can conceive, it would be impossible for man to thwart the purpose by which the entire motion of existence is maintained. We might be able to blow our planet out of its orbit or some minor little thing like that. But as far as being able to alter the complexion of purpose, even the most optimistic of us, even the most egotistic, have certain reservations as to their own capacities in this matter. It becomes pretty obvious that this universe is run by an efficient process of law, that these laws are unchangeable and not to be corrupted by man, that these laws are infinite and eternal, that these laws are adequate to cope with any situation that can arise within the infinite processes of existence. Science is even suggesting a little now that probably the atomic fission which we have achieved is not the first example of this in space. Even assuming that men or creatures with intellect on other planets had never done anything like this, or that nowhere in the cosmos was a group of scientists with the same degree of enthusiastic audacity, the fact remains the very processes of creation, the dissolution of solar systems, the absorption and reemergence of cosmic chains, these very processes involve great chemical, electrical, physical phenomena infinitely beyond even our conception. Consequently, nature must be large enough to take care of the sundering of a million cosmic chains and still be unperturbed. Because something is happening somewhere in space every second. And most of these happenings are bigger than anything we can even visualize or conceive of. If, therefore, there is a plan and a purpose, it appears to be large enough to take care of itself. In this, it differs from man, who has never been large enough to take care of himself. If the universe, therefore, has in it some natural policy, we are then in ethics compelled to assume that whatever this pattern is, we must call good. Because it is impossible for us to conceive of something that is all-powerful and not good. Even if to the inhabitants of some other cosmic chain far, far away, the policies of this one might not be acceptable, still, for us, the way of the existence of which we are a part has to be good. There's no use arguing with it. If we want to call it bad, we can. But even beyond good and bad, it simply is. And about this fact, there's nothing we can do. Perhaps then we may say that our personal interpretation of good is that we come into harmony with this plan and follow its rules and dictates and gain certain security through obedience to that which we cannot disobey and survive. Thus, good sets itself as one of the natural attributes of the creating power in which we have our hope. This power, philosophically considered, takes on the aspects of mind. It is infinite mind, universal mind, cosmic mind. And by extension, we may assume that it is also cosmic consciousness. For consciousness, as we experience it, is never entirely separate from mental phenomena. So at the root of existence, there has to be a mind or a mindfulness in which this plan exists, and by which power this plan is perpetuated and continued through the infinite durations that we can barely seek to define. We cannot really experience them at all. So the philosopher moves on to the ground that the universe is real, that its laws are real, that its principles are essentially just, and that everything that happens in nature happens for a reason, and that it happens because it is necessary for it to happen, or in some way that which occurs is acceptable to the plan, even though it may not be acceptable to man. Man, having somewhat an overestimated sense of his own ability to interpret the universe, cannot always justify nature. But he still has to abide by its edicts, whether he likes them or not. If, then, a thing like evil arises in our experience of the universe, it is like the ills that arise in our personal experience. They represent our own inabilities to accept or adjust or obey, but they do not constitute weaknesses or failings in the cosmic plan itself. Philosophy, therefore, actually more or less assumes that the creator of things is the real or only true philosopher, and that therefore everything that this creator does is wise, thoroughly thought through with a wisdom that transcends human comprehension, and that consequently our problem is not to shake our fists and say why, in the sense of why does it happen. Our problem is to thoughtfully attempt to discover those reasons by which the happening has become inevitable. Now, if we think a little bit, we can do this pretty well with the problem of the bomb. We know that the bomb is a perfectly natural evolutionary progress in military armament. We know that day by day, century by century, we move from a rough stone hurled by hand to a slingshot, to a hatchet, to a bow and arrow, to a spear, a lance, a javelin, finally to the beginning of machines of war, to the invention of gunpowder, round shot, shrapnel, many things of this nature, finally the comparatively primitive bombs of the last century, and at last to the present situation. This has been the natural growth of man's means of destroying. This growth would not have been possible had man not continually excited it, made it happen, in the causes which he regarded to be righteous warfare. He used these means either for defense or offense, and he was perfectly willing to keep on doing these things and creating new instruments until he suddenly reached the point where the instrument turned on him. And he discovered something so powerful that he became afraid of his own ingenuity. This is a perfectly natural procedure, just as natural as the growing of a child or the unfolding of a business policy. This was nothing exceptional, remarkable, or incredible. It was simply the fact that man had his eye on destruction and he kept it there. And he became ever more proficient in the perfection of the means for destroying. Thus, it is not something that fell out of heaven, or something which the devil whispered in his ear. It is something by which, gradually through the ages, he has sought more and more means for enforcing his demands and exploiting his fellow men. This situation, therefore, is little more or less than poetic justice, that it should come back upon him as he himself sent it forth. These facts, however, are not a great deal of consolation as we ponder the newspaper at the moment. But there are certain consoling principles that we have to bear in mind. First of all, philosophy teaches us that everything in the universe that is real is indestructible. Even science takes much the same attitude. If man wishes to regard himself merely as an animated body and chooses to decide that if this body is blown up, that is the end of him, this is his choice. This is his interpretation. This is his learned and unreasonable answer to very definite problems. But the fact that he takes this attitude does not make it true, nor does it make it inevitable or factual in any sense of the word. One of our problems is, very frankly, that the average individual does not have any clear internal conviction on the subject of immortality. He has a hope that he may survive to a better place, but he is by no means convinced of it as far as his own daily living is concerned. He is not certain in his own nature that he is immortal. This uncertainty is racking his life desperately at this time. Furthermore, he has lived so long within the narrow environment of his present physical existence that this has become tremendously real to him. The things he is doing have become tremendously real. The attachments have become tremendously real. And it is not unreasonable or wrong that they should be very vivid in his consciousness. But as Buddha pointed out 2,600 years ago, as long as we make this world the sovereign reality and the conditions that exist here the most important things in our lives, we are going to live forever on the brink of ruin. There is no escape from it. If peace would produce, for example, physical immortality, so that we might continue in these various associations that we now like, and of course have to be bothered with some we do not like, they might make a little more sense in this. But even this is not true. As somewhere in each life, we must discard all of it. We must discard every association and every acquaintance that we have. Some feel that it is better to pass out of this life peacefully in bed, surrounded by our weeping relatives. This, however, is a little dramatic and nostalgic, but some of the individuals near transition have, with their last feeble voice, requested the relatives to leave so that they could die in peace. So there is a great question as to whether there is the happy way or the happiest way to depart from this world. But one thing is certain, regardless of how much money we have or how little, regardless of the status which we attain or do not attain, we are ultimately to depart into that quiet and peaceful area which Gray describes in his elegy to a country churchyard. This is the end for physical life as we know it for the person. If this then becomes a fact, we all finally accept it when we write our insurance policies, then why do we build such a tremendous psychological pressure over this situation? Why not admit that we are here, that we came from a previous state of existence, and that we will go to a subsequent state of existence? While we are here, we pass through certain experiences. It might possibly be a bad marriage, or it might be an atomic bomb, but they're both unpleasant while they endure. We may have grateful or ungrateful children. We may rise to station or continue in obscurity. But we came, we are here, and we will depart. Our real philosophic interest, therefore, is concerned with this power, this thing, this being that comes, abides, and departs, and not with the carcass that is going to be laid away in one of our better mausoleums. This division, therefore, between the person and the body, this recognition that man is a being, that man as a being has had an eternal existence and will have, that man as a being has gotten himself into trouble since the beginning of the great cycles of existence, and will probably get himself into trouble for a number of cycles into the future. But that by some wonderful machinery of the infinite, man has never been able to destroy himself. And in spite of all his noblest efforts in that direction, he never will. If we can begin to get this philosophical concept, so magnificently expounded by Plato and Socrates, and also so clearly enunciated by Buddha, we are in a much better condition to face the simple fact of life. And that is that we must all face transition, regardless of how it comes or where it comes from. And that therefore our primary purpose in being here is to live and to learn and to do and to grow and to help, with the full understanding that when our allotted time comes, that will be it. If we accept this as we accept other evident facts of nature, we will not be in a pandemonium over a particular incident that may arise. It was a tragic circumstance that two little boys were buried in the collapse of a little cave or tunnel they had built, or others had built for them, a few days ago. We know what this meant to the suffering parents. We know what this meant to the little ones themselves, to be thus suddenly rejected out of our mortal way of life. But was anything killed, anything actually destroyed? Is this a tragedy in nature? Or is it simply an incident in a life that is so magnificently surrounded by protective machinery that true tragedy and real tragedy is impossible? If there is a tragedy at all in this universe, if there is a tragedy for man in this world, the real tragedy is that he shall leave here no better than he arrived.